tonight. Three 50-lap feature events for the Tiger Sportsman Cars. It's Run What You Brung Night, and the battle for the American-Canadian Tour Late Model Championship Cars continues with Derek O'Donnell, Nick Sweet, and all the other great stars of championship racing. This evening is the next-to-last night race of the year. Don't miss it at the nation's Side of Excitement, Barry's Thunder Road. Post time, 6 o'clock.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. A little drizzly out there this morning. Thanks for spending part of your morning with us. I was psyched to hear Roger Hill say this morning, we got another big heat wave coming our way next week. Temps in the 80s to start the week Monday and Tuesday. Gotta love that. Coming up on the program in just a moment here, we're going to chat with our friend Eric Davis, professor, political science professor emeritus at Middlebury College. We'll chat a little bit about the legacy of Jim Jeffords. Also, we'll talk a little bit about the gubernatorial race. Been kind of a interesting week on that front. We'll take your phone calls throughout as well. We'd love to hear from you at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And if it's a toll call for you to reach us, feel free to call us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. A couple of quick programming notes for you. I'm really happy to tell you on Monday we have Rich Harwood coming back on the program. You may recall he was the guy that we had on the program a couple of times after the Newtown shootings, talking about trauma in communities and how communities can heal. I think it's pretty obvious why I invited him on the program, the story coming out of Missouri. Also next week on this same topic, though I may share part of her piece with you this morning, Malkia Cyril is going to be joining us, who has been talking about this idea of Black Twitter and the open internet, and I'll share with you what some of her thoughts and comments are in advance of our discussion with her coming up next week. Also next week, Congressman Peter Welch joins us on the program. Joining us live on the line right now, let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to political science professor emeritus Eric Davis. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, Mark.
Jim Jeffords, what's the legacy?
Well, I would say Jim Jeffords should be looked at both in terms, in three different ways. What impact he had on Vermont politics, what impact he had on national politics, and what impact he had on the substance of legislation. In terms of Vermont politics, I think if you look at Jim Jeffords' career, it really encapsulates the change in Vermont politics over the last 35 years or so. He was first elected statewide in 68 as attorney general. He was a relatively young man. He was still in his 30s then. He ran for governor the first time, and his first competitive real statewide race was running for governor in the Republican primary in 72.
Mm-hmm.
And he lost that primary to Fred Hackett. It was an open governor seat. Dean Davis wasn't running for re-election. Jeffords was defeated in the Republican primary by Fred Hackett, and that's the last time Jeffords lost to a more conservative candidate in the Republican primary.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffords came back 2 years later. It was an open a U.S. House seat because Dick Mallory, who was the congressman, was running for the U.S. Senate when George Aiken retired, the seat that Pat Leahy won. Jeffords won the open House seat and stayed in the House for 14 years. He was one of a group of, in those days, there was still maybe 10% of the House Republicans, somewhere between 15 and 25 members, were moderates from the Northeast. So Jeffords had a fair number of colleagues from other states in New England, New York, Pennsylvania, and so forth.
Yeah,
but he was known for voting against Ronald Reagan. I remember back in 1981, Reagan's first year in office, Jeffords voted against nearly all of Reagan's major proposals regarding taxes and budgets.
Yeah,
Jeffords, you remember, and listeners may remember, he occasionally had challenges from the conservative wing of the Republican Party in primaries here in Vermont, but always would defeat those people, usually 2-1 or so, sometimes even a bit more. So he stayed in the House for 14 years. And then when Bob Stafford retired from the Senate in 88, Jeffords won election to the Senate, and he served three terms there. And, quote, in his final term in the spring of 2001, he left the Republican Party. He had just been reelected as a Republican in the fall of 2000. Then in the spring of 2001, he left the Republican Party and became an independent, caucused with the Democrats, and that switched control of the U.S. Senate to the Democrats for the remainder of that cycle. And then Jeffords continued to serve in the Senate until 06 when he retired. And just as he had been a strong opponent of Ronald Reagan on many issues and George H.W. Bush, so too with George W. Bush in Jeffords' final term in the Senate. In terms of his impact on national politics, I think probably his most important impact was that last, what he did in the last term of leaving the Republican Party and turning control of the Senate over to the Democrats. And by the time Jeffords retired from the Senate, there were hardly any moderate Republicans left.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
I mean, there used to be a lot of them. I mean, I think of people like Edward Brooke from Massachusetts and Olympia Snow and Susan Collins from Maine. Collins is still there. Jacob Javits from New York. Roger Goodell, the football commissioner, his father, Charles Goodell, was a Republican moderate senator from New York. Lowell Weicker from Connecticut, and almost all of those moderate Republicans were replaced by Democrats when they retired, or in a couple of instances, Jeffords and Allen Specter, they actually left the Republican Party.
Yeah, same in the House too. I mean, it was
same in the House.
Chris Shays at one point.
Christopher Shays from Connecticut, Silvio Conti from Western Massachusetts, Olympia Snow before she was elected to the Senate from Maine, Bill Cohen from Maine. And the Northeast moderate Republicans are basically an extinct group right now. So in terms of national politics, you know, Jeffords' career, I think typifies what's been going on in the Northeast more generally. And then in terms of policy, I think what he'll probably be remembered most for is some of the things he did when he was chair of the Senate Education Committee, focusing particularly on aid to disabled children, increase in federal support for special education during the time he was chair of that committee.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, I had a good discussion earlier this week with Howard Coffin, who worked for him for a long time.
Yes.
And was his friend. And he really highlighted, too, his work as attorney general and his environmental work and talked about that, too.
Yeah. I don't know that much about his work as attorney general. That was before I was in Vermont. But in the Senate, yes, it's interesting that Vermont senators sort of have tended to specialize on different sorts of things. And Bob Stafford started the emphasis on education and the environment. And after Stafford retired, Jeffords continued working on those two issues.
Mm-hmm. How substantive, though, was the change? Because the Senate went back into Republican control.
Yeah, the Senate went back and it flipped back and forth. It went back to Republican in 2002. It became Democratic in 2006. We'll see what happens to the Senate this year. I would say that it was important for those 2 years of the Bush administration, but the larger impact, I think, is it's part of the general trend toward more polarization in the Senate and national politics in general. Just as the Northeast moderate Republicans have disappeared, the moderate and conservative Southern Democrats have disappeared too. And I'm not talking about the racist Southern Democrats. They were a completely different group. But there were centrist, moderate, center-right Democratic senators from the South, like Sam Nunn from Georgia or Fritz Hollings from South Carolina. And again, when they retired, they were replaced by Republicans.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say is the reason why the Northeast moderates have become extinct?
I would say it's because of national trends in the Republican Party that started really with Nixon's Southern strategy in 68 and continued with Reagan's unsuccessful presidential primary run in 76 and then Reagan's successful run in 80. That with Nixon and Reagan, the Republican Party nationally moved much more to the right, became much more Southern in its focus, Southern in terms of where it obtained its voting support from.
Mm-hmm. 50 years from now, will we put Jim Jeffords in the same category as a George Aiken?
I'm not sure. Aiken was in public office for so long. The other thing was in Vermont, when the Republican Party was the dominant party in the state, it really had two wings. There was the moderate, if not even progressive on some issues, wing, the so-called Aiken-Gibson wing that was based down in in Windham County with Senator Aiken and Ernest Gibson, senior and junior. And then there was the more conservative, stalwart, diehard wing that was based in Rutland, and the Proctors were important in that. So Aiken was important not just because he held office for such a long time, because of what he did in some policies like rural electrification, agriculture, and so forth, but also because he was really one of the leaders in that very important wing of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well then where would you put Jeffords in kind of the pantheon?
I mean, I guess, you know, if you sort of, you know, have your senators at the, you know, sort of at the very top of the pyramid, I think, in terms of the people who represented Vermont in the Senate and aren't there anymore. I think George Aiken is in the top group. I put Jim Jeffords and Bob Stafford right below in the next tier down.
All right. Let's switch topics here. I want to talk about the gubernatorial race. This week, I thought it was a very poor decision on the part of Scott Mill to not participate in this Essex debate. Would you agree with me or
disagree?
Yeah, I agree.
It led to bad media coverage, although I was told by someone that Dan Feliciano managed to pack the hall for that debate so that Milne would have been going into sort of the tiger's den with a hall packed with supporters of the person who's seeking write-in support in the Republican Party. But I think Scott Milne's larger problem is that he still has not articulated a real vision and mission and purpose of why he is running for governor. You know, he talks about the satisfaction with someone, but he doesn't clearly articulate it. And more important, he doesn't clearly articulate what he would do if he happened to be elected governor. He hasn't talked much about policy. He doesn't hold press conferences about health care, about education, finance, and governance, about state budget and tax policy. So we know very little about what he would do, and he doesn't have enough money to buy advertising to get his message out.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't cost you any money to hold a press conference.
And I think back to Randy Brock 2 years ago. You know, Randy Brock would hold a lot of press conferences, you know, typically one, maybe one a week once the campaign got going, focus on a different issue each week, have a policy paper that he passed out. So, you know, that would lead to 1 or 2 days of stories.
Mm-hmm. So how do you explain this?
I think in part it's a first-time candidate. I mean, again, remember Randy Brock had run statewide before. He'd been auditor. He'd been in the Senate, so he was familiar with the issues. I think it's in part as if it is the organizational and financial weakness of the Milne campaign. And then part of it is, I think it's pretty obvious, and Feliciano is appealing to some of this, that there are still divisions within the Vermont Republican Party. We saw them earlier this year over a selection of a party chair. We're seeing them again in this campaign with, you know, some Republican activists and operatives like Darcy Johnston, who was involved with the Brock campaign 2 years ago and the Vermonters for Healthcare Freedom group, working on behalf of Feliciano.
Is the Republican Party in Vermont big enough to have divisions, Eric?
I don't think so. And, their only statewide office holder is Phil Scott, and it looks like that's going to be what the situation they'll be in after the election.
We're talking with Eric Davis. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. I'm really puzzled by the fundraising, too. I've spoken to it, I would say, 5 or 6 people in the last 3 days who would be obvious people, if you were a Republican, to ask, who would give money to any Republican candidate.
Right.
And all 5 told me that they haven't even been asked.
Well, I mean, I found it interesting that Republicans can raise money. I mean, look at Phil Scott's financial report that he filed earlier this week. He raised roughly $50,000 in the July-August period. He had some four-figure contributions from individuals. He had some contributions from business, many of them businesses that either do business with the state or are regulated by the state, the sort of businesses incumbents normally turn to. But Phil Scott has demonstrated that even in Vermont, it is possible for a Republican in a competitive race to raise $50,000 a month and thus about $200,000 to $250,000 over the course of a campaign. Now, it may be that some of these Republican sources, they're not given to Shumlin, that's for sure, that they're focusing on Scott this year. But obviously, Milne campaign is in a difficult position.
Is there any chance Dan Feliciano wins this nomination Tuesday?
I don't think he wins the nomination, but I don't know. I mean, normally I have a pretty good sense before an election of rough ranges in which candidates are going to do, but I don't have that in this Republican primary. In a normal year, a write-in candidate, might get at most a few hundred, maybe 1,000 votes, and we're going to have a low turnout this year, but still I expect, maybe 10 to 15,000 people will vote in the Republican primary. So in a normal year, I'd say Feliciano would get 10% or maybe a little bit less. But I just don't know how many people there are out there who are really opposed to single payer. It's not a majority of the state necessarily, but it could be a not insignificant group within the Republican Party. And how many of them will be motivated enough to come to the polls on Tuesday and write Dan Feliciano's name in? I just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure Scott Milne finishes first. But does Scott Milne get 85% or 65%? I just don't have a sense of that yet.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the lieutenant governor's race. I saw the Free Press at one point describe progressive Dean Corn, who's also trying to get the Democratic nomination, as the long shot. And I thought, that might be a little too strong.
Well, first of all, in terms of the Democratic write-in campaign, Corn told his people at his kickoff event last week that he has a goal of getting about 3,000 write-in votes. Now, I'm estimating a turnout of about 30,000 in the Democratic primary. So Corn hopes to get 1 out of 10 participants in the Democratic primary to write in his name. That may be a bit high. He may not get quite that many, but still he'll certainly qualify. He'll certainly get more than the 250 Democratic write-in votes he needs to be listed on the ballot as Democrat as well as progressive. What I'm interested to see, assuming that happens, is how much organizational support will he get from the Democratic Party if he's the nominee? Will they include him on mailings along with other Democratic candidates? Will the field organization ask people to vote for Corn as well as other Democrats? Because we do know there are some elected Democrats who are supporting Phil Scott, some of his colleagues in the Senate, Dick Sears, Dick Mazza, John Campbell. So the Democratic Party, even if Corn is listed on the ballot, not all Democratic office holders will be supporting Corn. Some will be supporting Scott.
Yeah, but the governor said he'd support him, isn't that?
The governor said he'd support Corn. Now, again, we had the financial reports filed earlier this week, and Corn made a big deal about his relying on public financing as opposed to Scott raising money from private sources. I would very much, this is never going to happen, but I would like to see Dean Corn and Peter Shumlin have a debate about campaign finance. Because the points that Corn is making about the Scott campaign and where the financing comes from could be made to an even greater extent about the Shumlin campaign. The Shumlin campaign relies heavily on large contributions from individuals and businesses. A lot of the Shumlin contributions are $1,000 and up, and a very large number of them come from businesses, either again in-state that are regulated by or do business with the state, or out-of-state businesses and organizations that Shumlin has come in contact with in his role as chair of the Democratic Governors Association.
Mm-hmm. That would be a fun debate, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Yeah. You've said before that Peter Shumlin's governor as long as he wants to be. Anything change your mind on that?
No, nothing changing that.
All right. Any other races that any interest out there?
I think no other statewide races. There's a few legislative primaries in strongly Democratic districts where there are no Republicans running, where in effect the Democratic primary will have a large part to say in who's elected. There's the Windham County Senate race where Peter Galbraith is not running for re-election, so there's an open seat down there.
Yeah.
There's a House district in Middlebury where Paul Ralston's not running for re-election, where you have several Democrats contesting an open seat there. And I'm also interested in the Chittenden Senate Democratic primary. Again, the turnout's going to be really low, but what will the order of finish of the candidates be?
Mm-hmm.
Will Tim Ashe continue to come in first as he did in the last election? What will the ranking of the incumbent Democratic senators in Chittenden County be?
Let me take a call from Cabot and let you go. Tony, good morning.
Good morning. I always enjoy this guest. explains everything, and I can understand it, so that says something.
Yay.
What I'd like to ask is if you could take a step back and perhaps take a sociological perspective on how it is that the two parties, whether you look at state or whether you look at the federal government, have become so ingrained in terms of their dislike for one another. Do you have any sort of a sense? Can you offer any insight into that?
Yeah. I mean, clearly this polarization is developing, and, you know, I do think it's less highly developed in Vermont than it is in much of the rest of the country, and I think that's one of the things we should be fortunate enough. But political scientists and sociologists who've looked at this come up with a number of explanations. One of them is that the media has become more partisan and polarized. If you think back to 30, 40 years ago, when the principal sources of news were the evening news programs on the network, Walter Cronkite, Huntley Brinkley, and so forth, and they tended to present a middle-of-the-road, nonpartisan view. Now the networks that people watch for news are MSNBC, Fox News, and so forth, and both of them are much more partisan and cater to a partisan viewing audience. You have the rise of talk radio on both wings again. Sociologists have shown that people tend to live in areas where people with similar views congregate. I mean, it's not just that Democrats win a certain group of states and Republicans win a certain group of states, but the states that Democrats win tend increasingly to be 60% or more Democrats, and the same on the other side with the Republicans. People tend to marry people with similar political views. Again, that's something that sociologists have said has become more strong over the last 20 or 30 years. So you have sort of political identities transmitted then through households from parents to children. So you have a whole set of things that are working in conjunction with each other. The media, family patterns, resident patterns, residential patterns, and they all contribute to this greater polarization of the political system.
Well, and then there's this redistricting argument, right?
I mean, yeah, there's redistricting, and in those states that, you know, Vermont obviously has only an at-large district, but in those states where there are more than one congressional district, the technology of redistricting is now such that incumbents who control their own redistricting, legislators who draw district lines and so forth, can do it in a way that strongly benefits incumbents. Now, I'll just mention just at the end, Mark, that California made an interesting change in the way it does districting starting in the last election. It went into effect in 2012, where the district's lines are drawn by an independent commission now rather than by members of the legislature. And the other change that went along with that in California is for the primary, they now have what they call the top two system. And what it is it's one primary that's open to everybody. It's not a Democratic primary or Republican primary. It's an open primary. You can vote for whoever you want. And whichever candidates get the two highest vote totals in the primary then run off in the general election. Now, in most of California, it ends up that it's one Democrat and one Republican. But in some strongly Democratic areas, like Northern California, it ends up being two Democrats in the general election. And in some strongly Republican areas in Southern California, it's two Republicans. So what you have in those districts is, for the general election, usually a moderate Democrat running against a progressive Democrat, or a moderate Republican running against a conservative Republican. And I wonder whether that system, for a state that does have a more polarized politics, might be better than what we have now. I think the verdict is still out, but I'm interested to see how it develops over the next several election cycles.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your time. As always, I appreciate it.
You are most welcome, Mark.
Eric Davis, a political science professor emeritus who taught for decades at Middlebury College, kind enough to join us on the program here on a regular basis. Huh. All right. It's interesting. You know, it is interesting. When you think about Jim Jeffords and you think about the makeup of the congressional makeup in the Northeast, I mean, it really is pretty amazing. When Jim Jeffords was elected to the House in 74, I mean, there were the number of moderate Republicans. I remember at one point Chris Shays of Connecticut was the last Republican in the Northeast. I mean, wow, pretty remarkable. We'd love to hear from you this morning. We'll take your phone calls the rest of the way. You can reach us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. I'd be curious your thoughts and comments on maybe you have a story you'd like to share with us about Senator Jim Jeffords. What do you make of the Republican gubernatorial race? Curious to know what you think about that. And one of the questions that I'd like to pose to you this morning is this question about negotiating for hostages. The journalist who was killed, there were attempts by this group that was holding him to try to negotiate his release. And there is a real division. The United States and Britain do it one way, which is to not negotiate, and there are other European countries that have, kind of sending a bit of a mixed message, and we can debate some of the pros and cons of that as well, too. Also, I want to talk a little bit about the situation out in Ferguson, Missouri as well. Your thoughts, comments are welcome at 244-1777 is our local number. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Dan Feliciano, a write-in...